Hi, I'm Michelle Shepard, host of Uncover Sharmini from CBC Podcasts. In 1999, 15-year-old Sharmini Anandaville disappeared on her way to a job that police believed didn't exist. 4 months later, her remains were found in a wooded ravine. I revisit the case that has stayed with me for over 20 years, ever since I first covered it as a cub crime reporter for the Toronto Star. You can find Uncover Sharmini on CBC Listen or on your favorite podcast app.
This is a CBC podcast.
Hello, I'm Neil Kirksall.
And I'm Chris Howden. This is As It Happens, the podcast edition. Tonight,
full court mess. A federal court finds the government is failing Canadians by failing to fill dozens of judicial vacancies. I'll speak with the human rights lawyer who brought the case against the federal government.
Getting with the program. For years, Polish TV said ugly, discriminatory things about the queer community. Now a journalist has apologized. One activist tells us what that apology meant and why it's just a first step.
Net loss. Officials in Senegal are starting to make a habit of blocking internet access. A human rights activist explains why he is fighting that tactic in an international court.
Mother of intervention. Cecilia Gentili dedicated her life to advocating for trans rights. One of her chosen daughters tells us how the late activist inspired her to embrace her true self.
High roller. At the Super Bowl halftime show, Usher wore a brand new pair of roller skates, which may be the brand new key to getting more people involved in the sport, at least according to one excited skater. Sign me up.
And a dad giveaway. It may seem unlikely that an Arizona candidate's three young kids each donated thousands to his campaign, but he says it's a given that they gave it voluntarily. As it happens, the Tuesday edition, radio that assumes he granted them certain allowances. A federal court judge tore a strip off the Trudeau government today. Justice Henry S. Brown ruled that, quote, the Prime Minister and Minister of Justice are simply treading water, unquote, when it comes to keeping the country's courts staffed with judges. Justice Brown went on to say that in the process, they had failed all those who have unsuccessfully sought timely justice in the superior courts and federal courts across Canada. The decision follows a letter to the Prime Minister last year in which Supreme Court Chief Justice Richard Wagner warned of an impending crisis in Canada's courts if dozens of vacancies weren't filled. Yavor Hamid is the human rights lawyer who brought the case against the federal government. We reached him in Ottawa.
Yavor, what does the failure Justice Brown refers to in the decision look like in real life, in a courtroom, for someone seeking justice?
Not having a judge available means you don't get your day in court. You don't have a judge who's prepared to hear you. For my clients, some of which who suffer from post-traumatic stress and other, you know, debilitating disabilities, not being able to adjudicate your concern means that you're waiting for months, maybe years, just to be heard. And that's on civil matters. You know, in the area of criminal law, you're looking at not having a trial or perhaps not even being released in a timely fashion.
And how do your clients, how have they been reacting in those most difficult cases to having justice delayed?
It's never a good thing. The court system is typically, it's not a friendly process. No one likes to go to court. And I had a case back in 2022 that was delayed for about 4 months. We were ready, prepared to go to trial, and on the eve of trial, we were told there were just no judges, so we had to postpone it. And that's just unacceptable, and it just increases the anxiety of the person who wants to get their dispute resolved.
Minister Virani has responded with a statement, and he also posted it on social media, and I'll read some of it now. He wrote, in 6 months as minister, because he just got the job in the summer, he says, in 6 months as minister, I've appointed 64 judges. That was Harper's average annual number. I'm working twice as fast, referring to previous Harper government. He goes on to say, this means we do have more positions to fill, but make no mistake, there are still more judges sitting today than ever in our history. That's again from Minister Virani. So why is it a failure now?
I mean, the problem is a cumulative one. As Justice Brown noted, the statistics are just not they're not adequate. You know, the crisis is appalling and untenable, as he's called it. And until those numbers go down in terms of what the vacancies are, the court is noting that there could be best efforts that are being made, but the problem has to be remedied, and it has to be remedied in a reasonable amount of time. And so it's great. It's great that the minister is saying that he's taking it seriously. I don't expect any less. But the fact that this is now in a judicial pronouncement, in a declaration, that means there is a serious, serious responsibility that is not just about the minister's discretion to do this. There's a legal obligation at play.
What is at play, though, in your view? Why aren't these positions being filled?
I mean, it's a good question. The government says that, look, we're not getting qualified candidates, and you know, to some extent, there could be some truth in that. But then I think what the court is highlighting is that there needs to be greater efforts. There need to be more efforts. Those vacancies need to be filled. And it's not good enough to sort of rest on your laurels to say, look, my track record is better than our predecessor. The vacancies need to be filled, because tangibly, when those vacancies are not filled, we just don't have the level of judicial support to be able to deal with the cases we need to deal with. Now, there's two problems. One is that you don't have enough judges to adjudicate cases, but the flip side of that is that for the judges who are there, the workload is doubled and tripled, because they don't have the support from their colleagues. And so the status quo, what we have now, that's the thing, that's the crisis that Justice Brown's talking about.
Minister Varani went on to say in that statement and those social media posts, there are multiple factors that contribute to court delays, and we call upon the provinces and territories to also do their part to help. So he's saying they need to do more. Should they be doing more?
I mean, it's a collaborative process, certainly. But one of the issues that was raised, even in federal court before Justice Brown, where my colleague Nicholas Pope argued, Justice Brown raised that concern. But ultimately, it doesn't detract from what the federal minister's responsibility is. And so, yes, there are logistical constraints and there's provincial responsibilities, but more can be done. And this is what was highlighted by Justice Brown, is that there is a legal responsibility. And when there's a legal responsibility, the corollary to that is that a way forward has to be found. And it's not just a trifling matter. This is probably the most serious access to justice concern that we have in the country, because it means the very basis of adjudicating any kind of dispute, essentially getting justice. And when justice is delayed, that's effectively being denied.
Does this decision sort of set a clock now? I mean, do you anticipate this backlog being covered, or these positions being filled, these judges being appointed much more quickly now?
Well, the court doesn't set a specific timetable, but what Justice Brown says is that it needs to be remedied in a reasonable amount of time. That could mean within 6 months to a year. But I do think that there is implicitly, just given the language of the court, there is a time clock. There is a pressure that's being put on this. And the other thing that the federal court has left open to us or myself and you know, other lawyers who may want to do this, come forward and come back before the court if in say, for example, 6 months, this is not remedied. So that is something that we're looking into. We hope that the government is going to do the right thing, is going to close this gap, and we'll obviously be looking at it very closely.
What will you do if it's not filled, if these positions aren't filled in a reasonable time period, a time period that you feel is reasonable?
It may be that that we come back before the court. The court has sort of given us that nod that we can do it. It's not an easy thing, as my colleague Nicholas Pope, who argued the case. This takes many, many hours of preparation to do on a pro bono basis. Mm-hmm. But we're ready to do it. We're ready for that fight if it calls for it.
Yavor, thank you.
My pleasure.
Yavor Hamid is a human rights lawyer. We reached him in Ottawa. It happened again today, like it did last week, and time and again since July. The government of Senegal shut down internet access on all mobile phones, citing safety concerns. For the vast majority of the population, phones are the only way online. The tactic has been used repeatedly since federal elections were delayed, sparking outrage and demonstrations. One such protest was scheduled for this morning, but last night authorities announced that it had been banned. The human rights organization Afriktivist is suing the government of Senegal over the internet shutdowns in an international African court. Papa Ismaila Dieng is an advocacy officer with that group. We reached Mr. Dieng in Dakar, Senegal.
Ismaila, you were out on the streets of Dakar today. What did you see?
So many police forces and what we call in French gendarmerie in the street. They didn't want people to protest, as the protest was forbidden yesterday by officials, saying that it will cause some troubles in the city. And so many of them, I didn't see a gun, but they have their shields, they have tear gases, and they have some sticks to beat people if they protest.
So the protest that was supposed to happen this morning, the government was able to shut it down before it even happened.
Yes, they were able to shut it down. And at the same time, the organizers told people not to protest today, as the authority didn't allow it to take place. And they are preparing another one on February 17th.
What is it like for you to see your city like that?
It's something I can get used to. And we're having it more and more. We have it on the last 2 or 3 years now. That's very scary for people. Like, you get out of your house and you see so many policemen, so many police cars and trucks waiting for people, and you know they're just here to beat people if they try to protest. If protestation is constitutional right, it's written in our constitution, but you have they're using so many forces to shut down protestation, and we do not understand why.
It's something you cannot get used to, you said. It surprises you to see that many law enforcement officers,
yeah,
even.
Exactly.
When we speak about shutdowns, yeah, the internet was shut down again today.
Yeah.
How is that impacting how people get any information online?
That's very difficult for people to get information online if they are not on the Wi-Fi. The problem is more than 96% of Senegalese people who are using internet are doing it with mobile data. So Wi-Fi is just for 4 or 3% of Senegalese internet users. So you can imagine the number of people who cannot access to internet today, who cannot have information today, who cannot buy anything on the internet today, as they do it every day.
And just in terms of people's daily lives, I mean, they may not be involved in protests or political activity at all, but how does this affect them every day?
Some simple things you do every day, like buying stuff on internet, like watching movies on the internet, like talking to your family on the internet that you cannot do. And you have like people as me who work on internet every day. It's very complicated for people like to be informed of what's going on. Some people were calling me in the day and saying, do you know if there is protest somewhere? Because I've got some, I have to go out for some of my myself, and I do not know if there is protest there. And I really couldn't inform them of what was going on in the streets of Dakar.
The government communications ministry has said they need to block the internet access to stop people from sharing messages that the government describes as, quote, hateful and subversive, and to prevent, quote, deadly protests. Three people did die during protests last week. But in the answer to the question why they're doing this, what do you make of those answers, their justifications for blocking this access? Are they just trying to maintain order and keep people safe?
No, there are two ways to maintain order and keep people safe. The first thing is, like, as you said, that there were three deaths last week in the protest, but those people were shot to death by police. So the first thing for the government to avoid people dying in the street is to tell the police not to shoot people. That's the first thing. And the second thing is, they have just one thing to do to maintain people and order, people at home and order, is to respect the Constitution and people's rights to have election.
How do you think this lawsuit that you're a part of can help?
The first thing, as you said, the lawsuit is a way to tell the world what's going on. They cannot, like, if they shut down internet here, they cannot shut down internet at the ECOWAS courts. They cannot stop the ECOWAS court on dealing with the case, and the case will be public, so the world will know. The first thing. The second thing is, we want the court to say to our states that internet is not a privilege for people; it's a right for people. It's a right for people to talk on the internet and to spread their ideas, their opinions on what's going on. First, it's the right for people to get information from the internet. It's the right for medias to have internet to inform people. And our government like, for them, internet is a privilege. It's like you tell your kids who weren't very nice, okay, now tonight you will not watch TV, or tonight you will not have your dessert after dinner. That's how they're behaving with us. And the court will help us tell them, say, people have the right to internet. You cannot cut internet from them. Internet is a part of our life, of our daily basis life. It's not about just politics or something. And as we're going in an electoral process, the candidates will use internet to talk to their people.
Ismaila, thank you for your time.
Thank you again, Neil, for the invitation.
Papa Ismaila Dieng is an advocacy officer with the human rights organization Afrique Diviste. We reached him in Dakar, Senegal. We're going to play something for you now. It's very short, but it's very significant, and it's in Polish.
Przepraszam.
Well, that means I'm sorry, and it meant a lot to a lot of people. That was a journalist named Wojciech Szelang making an apology live on Poland's public broadcaster. He was apologizing for years of what he called shameful words directed at the country's 2S LGBTQ plus community on air, years when the right-wing Law and Justice Party was in power. Two activists were in the TV studio listening to that apology. One of them is Bart Staszewski. We reached him in Warsaw.
Bart, take us back into that television studio with you. You're sitting right across from this television host, this journalist. Did you expect to get an apology that day?
Not really. I was really prepared for just a normal short interview, like on a daily basis, but first time there, first time in the public TV, and suddenly he made this appearance with the apology, which was a big, huge news also for us in the studio.
I don't speak Polish, but just even listening to the clip, watching the full clip with subtitles, it was quite moving. What was it like for you to hear those words, "I'm sorry"?
I mean, I was never expecting that I need them so much. Because for many years we were a target. LGBT people were a target of the government, and public TV was the tool in their hands, portraying us as some kind of enemy. I remember the headlines from the public TV, like "LGBT ideology destroys the family," and it was the real quotes from the journalists over there, the hosts, who was accusing us of the worst. So an apology is an important ingredient of healing, actually. Now I know it. I get the same. I was moved by his words, and you could really hear him shaking, that it was not something that was really prepared. And yes, it was a beautiful moment.
What did he tell you about why he made that apology?
He told that this is the honest thing to do, the thing that should happen. And many people commenting on the internet tell that we are not used to this normality of situation where you do something wrong, you make an apology, and suddenly a good person, good man in TV is doing what should be done many years ago. We should never be a target of the government, and suddenly somebody is giving us this dignity.
And we should be clear, Wojciech Szelang only recently started working for TVP. He did not make those anti-gay remarks that you've been talking about.
He's the last person to make an apology, but this decency, which he has in his character, made him knew that this is the good, correct thing to do, the normal thing, but usually we don't see it too much.
What kind of impact did those earlier words, those earlier attacks, the ones he's since apologized for, have?
Those was horrible things, because when it happens once, you could think that this is some kind of one-time error or problem. But I remember 2019, 2020, when the public TV, state TV, was like on daily basis, really focusing on the LGBT topics, showing us as some kind of enemy. And they accuse us that what we are doing is an LGBT ideology. We are a threat to the Polish nation. And by the LGBT ideology, they mean pride parades, they mean two men, two women holding hands in the public, because it's a promotion of sin, and promotion of sin is some kind of gay lifestyle, gay ideology. So this is something that in 21st century should never happen in the middle of Europe. We don't have civil unions, we don't have a hate speech law, nothing protects us from what was happening then. Now, with the new government, they promise to give the new law, which will protect us from the hatred, the refresh criminal code. Civil unions are on the way, so something is happening. We are, of course, watching carefully the politicians, but this is the new chapter, let's say.
Does Poland feel safer to you now?
I mean, I was the enemy of many politicians who was really targeting me, and still trying to find myself in this new situation when I don't need to be a warrior for this cause. I need to cooperate with the politicians on the very different conditions. It's hard for many activists. We want to cooperate with them. We carefully approach those politicians' promise to us. And I see that they are doing that. What I want to mention that 2 weeks ago, we met with the Justice Minister, Adam Bodnar, which also made in his first words the apology. So hearing that from this very good human rights defender for many years, he was working as ombudsman, made me think that this is really something new.
It is a significant shift. I mean, thinking back to when you were on our program a few years ago, you were telling us about how some communities had declared themselves LGBTQ plus free zones. You know, these are words, as you've said, these are first steps. But you've also said you'd like to see a further apology from the highest level, from Prime Minister Donald Tusk now.
Yeah, because I think that there are always times when the highest level politicians are making an apology for the past things that happened. The unique thing that happened in Poland, that the own country targeted their own people, the minority living here, is something that should be recognized by the top politicians. I have seen the comments on the internet, how big was the impact of this short video I posted on the Twitter, where people was telling me, Bart, I was crying. I mean, gay people from Poland was telling Bart, I was crying. So how much we want this apology, how much it's necessary for this healing process. Apology is the first step, then is to make the people accountable for what they was doing, this horrible idea of the LGBT free zone that happened around the Poland. The one third of Poland was with those horrible acts. Many people left Poland. Now they are living in Germany, Sweden, some left even the States, and they will never get back because their own country were against them. So how you want to make the new generation, which is here, to restore this trust into the politicians' words?
Bart, thank you.
Thank you so much.
Bart Staszewski is a 2S LGBTQ plus activist. He's in Warsaw. Children love to help their parents. I mean, whose kids haven't begged to clean the chimney, like in Mary Poppins, or pleaded to stay up a little longer so they can finish cleaning the chandelier with a toothbrush? But what kids really love is to spend years saving up every dollar they got from birthdays and Christmases and the tooth fairy, and then give that money to their dad because they respect him so much. This is the normal thing that Conor O'Callaghan plausibly reports happened to him. Mr. O'Callaghan is running in the Democratic primary in Arizona's 1st Congressional District, so he has been fundraising, and his perseverance has deeply impressed three Arizonans, who each donated the maximum amount possible, $3,300. These Arizonans are Mr. O'Callaghan's elementary school-aged children. Now, after the Arizona Republic noticed these unusual acts of familial generosity, a reporter got in touch with the candidate, who explained, quote, "My oldest son saw all the work that I was putting into this campaign and asked if he's able to contribute. And then, like in any family dynamic, his younger brothers wanted to do the same thing," unquote. Well, this seems legal and relatable. Whom among us has not been so moved by our young children's love that we cashed their check for thousands of dollars? And what child has not yearned to spend a huge amount of money on a parent's political campaign rather than something boring like toys or a bike or college? But I do hope the candidate will refuse any further financial offers from his kids. I mean, there's only so much you can take. The town of Carmen, Manitoba, is grappling with a horrifying loss. As we told you yesterday on the program, police have charged Ryan Howard Manikisic with the murders of five people who were found dead in and around the community on Sunday. The victims were his partner, Amanda Clearwater, their three young children, and Ms. Clearwater's teenage niece. All five lived together in Carmen. Amid the shock and mourning, the community has come together to support the family and each other. Reverend Harold Kenyon leads Carmen United Church. We reached him in Carmen.
Reverend Kenyon, what kinds of questions are people in your community, in your church, asking today?
Well, I think today people are asking, how can we help? There's certainly been a circle of people gathered here at the church, just in our lobby, and they've been having conversation and kind of coordinating food and kind of next steps in the ways that we can support the Clearwater family.
And what have the last couple of days been like?
Well, we first heard what had happened. It was late in the afternoon on Sunday, and of course, everyone was terribly shocked and saddened to hear that such a crime had happened in our community to people we know and love. And since then, people have, we continue to try to process what's happened, but I think people are really trying to rally around the family and one another to be the support that, best support that we can offer.
Have you or anyone from your church had a chance to speak with the family?
I've not spoken with the family personally. But one of my colleagues in ministry has been over to the house, as well as some other people that were groups that we're connected to have been over to the house to be supportive of the family.
And what did they share about what the family is saying?
Well, they're grieving terribly, of course. Mm-hmm. They're just trying to figure out next steps themselves. It's a very complicated situation, and we want the family to have, you know, kind of control and say over what happens, where, and all that sort of thing. Whenever there's been people are victims of crime, there's people feel powerless, so we want to make sure that they stay in control of what they need.
It's still so fresh, I can only imagine, and the enormity of the loss. I mean, just looking at the names and ages.
We've all had kids and grandkids of this age, right? It's very shocking.
Just to tell our listeners or remind them, Amanda Clearwater, who was 30 years old, her children Bethany, 6, Javen, 4, and 2.5-year-old Isabella, were killed, as well as Amanda's niece, Maya Grattan, who was 17 years old. You said you know the family, Reverend. What can you tell us about them?
We've known them here at the church for, well, quite some time now. Amanda's mom lives just actually across the back lane from the church, so I guess we've always known them, and they've been involved in various kind of community initiatives and things that are happening in the neighborhood. So, yeah, we know them. We know the family well.
And what do you remember of the children?
Oh, the kids. Boy, that's hard. Kids are so sweet. You know, the one little girl was just in kindergarten, and we've just tried to be supportive of them.
I gather a little bit about what Carmen is like just from what you've said so far, but for people who've never seen it or hadn't heard about it until this case, how would you describe Carmen to them?
You know, Carmen is a pretty typical small prairie farming town. You know, it's a very tight-knit place as well. A lot of deep family connections. So, yeah, but I certainly, we've been very touched by the outreach from people all over the province and indeed far beyond. A lot of people have been reaching out and offering their prayers and support from to the town and to the folks here who are just trying to be good neighbors.
And you have more plans for tomorrow. What more will your church be doing to try to help?
Well, I say we're just kind of taking things day by day. Mm-hmm. And there's, it's not just our church, but it's a community effort. So there is a group in town called Carmen Wellness that's putting on a community supper tomorrow. They do it once a month. Such a thing happens in lots of congregations and communities all over Canada. People are invited to come and share a meal, and there will be extra support people available, you know, at that meal to just kind of just be with people to help us all process and grieve this. And the Clearwater family, you know, had certainly participated in the community meal in the past, and so there'll be a time for remembering them as well, I'm sure.
As the investigation unfolds, what questions do you have that you want answered?
I you know, at this point, the whole event is so incomprehensible to me. We're just dealing with the loss that is present to us right now.
Reverend Kenyon, I appreciate your time. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much, Neil. Blessings to you.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
Reverend Harold Kenyon leads Carmen United Church. We reached him in Carmen, Manitoba.
Hello, I'm Jess Milton. For 15 years, I produced The Vinyl Cafe with the late, great Stuart MacLean. Every week, more than 2 million people tuned in to hear funny, fictional, feel-good stories about Dave and his family. We're excited to welcome you back to the warm and welcoming world of The Vinyl Cafe with our new podcast, Backstage at The Vinyl Cafe. Each week, we'll share 2 hilarious stories by Stuart, and for the first time ever, I'll tell you what it was like behind the scenes. Subscribe for free wherever you get your podcasts.
She was an author, a performer, a devoted advocate for trans rights, a determined legislative lobbyist, and one of the lead plaintiffs in a successful lawsuit against the Trump administration, which had attempted to roll back protections for trans people in the Affordable Care Act. Her name was Cecilia Gentile. She died on February 6th at her home in Brooklyn. She was 52. Beyond all the roles and achievements I just listed, Ms. Gentile was a mother to many people in the queer community. Rio Sofia is one of those mourning her loss today. Ms. Sofia is the Programs and Operations Director at Queer Art, where Cecilia Gentile was on the board of directors, and she's also one of Ms. Gentile's daughters.
Rio, take us back in time. How did you first meet Cecilia?
I met Cecilia 1 week into moving to New York City in 2013. I was going to Apicha, which is a health clinic downtown where Cecilia had recently started working. I was going in for an STI check, and Cecilia just found me in the waiting room and was like, "You come with me." She saw something in me. She saw a budding trans woman, and she wanted to see what I needed.
And when you look back on that day, I mean, moving anywhere, let alone a big city, let alone New York, is a huge event. So to come into contact with someone who would later become so instrumental in your life is monumental. It's lucky. How do you remember that moment?
In retrospect, I feel so incredibly lucky. I got to find a mother, someone who really and truly became a mother to me. A couple of years ago, I got married to my partner, another trans person, a beautiful T4T wedding. And Cecilia, she encouraged me to have the wedding that I deserved and also that our community deserved. You know, in our community, we don't really get to see a lot of weddings. She knew that to celebrate love was something that we don't really get to do in a really great big way. And so she helped plan my wedding, and, you know, she got together with my biological mom. They helped each other pick their dresses, and she walked down the aisle with my mom to give me away. So from that one lucky day that I went for an STI check, I got a true, true trans mother.
Oh, that says a lot. That says everything you've said says a lot about who she was as a mother to you and as a person. In terms of her advocacy, her activism, Cecilia, we should tell our listeners, was born in Argentina, moved to the United States about 20 years ago or so. What did she tell you about how she came to move into the world of advocacy and activism?
So she lived in Miami for a few years and then was escaping an abusive relationship and moved up to New York City. And, you know, she has this beautiful story about how when she was a very young person in Argentina, her brother was teasing her and had convinced her that she was found on the railroad tracks and was left there by aliens. She spoke to her grandmother about it and was like, "You know what? Maybe you were, but one day I promise you that you will find your own planet, and you will find that those people on that planet are people just like you." Her grandmother was a really, really big support system for her in Argentina and was someone who could see her from very, very early on in her life. And her moving to New York is something that Cecilia felt was like that planet.
What did she say to you about the shift in culture, more visibility, acceptance, as always should have been, but also the difficulty still?
What I loved so much about Cecilia is that no matter what room that she was in, she always, always brought her full self. She didn't care about respectability politics. She cared about being honest and genuine. And I think that some of the trappings of being hyper-visible as trans people and so politicized is that we get put into a lot of pigeonholes about how it is that we can show ourselves. And for me, what she models for me is that I never have to hide who I am and that I can achieve great heights and get a lot done without having to compromise any part of myself. And so that for me is one of the big lessons that I think of when I think about the status quo, when I think about how people are reacting to, you know, the politicization of trans bodies and all of the incredibly awful anti-trans legislation that she fought for, that she made her legacy. And so that's what I'll be carrying with me.
It is very difficult to lose a loved one, let alone a mother or a mother figure. So how are you doing?
Yeah, I'm devastated. I am really, really shattered. I was living with Cecilia. Mm-hmm. Cecilia had just bought a beautiful 10-acre property in upstate New York, and it had two little houses, and she was living with her husband, Peter in one, and I was living with my husband Sid in another. And, you know, near the end of her life, she was just so excited about baking and gardening, and we had all of the space to garden. We had literally just, you know, made a trail through the woods so that our doors could be more directly connected to each other. And just, this wasn't the plan. She had so much more life to live. And so we are really, really hurting over here.
I'm so sorry, Rio. It was sudden.
It was very sudden.
My condolences to you, Rio. I appreciate you sharing your memories.
Thank you.
Rio Sofia is the Programs and Operations Director at Queer Art and one of Cecilia Gentili's daughters. Ms. Gentili died last week. She was 52. When Lil Jon asked the tens of thousands of fans in Las Vegas' Allegiant Stadium this weekend if they were ready to get crazy, they were probably kind of taken aback because the situation was already mind-blowing. The audience had already seen Usher amid an organized chaos of tumbling sequined circus performers and Alicia Keys wearing a gigantic magical cape. And then what seemed like an untoppable high point, Usher suddenly on roller skates, performing an awe-inspiring, tightly choreographed dance routine alongside other roller skaters. That part was especially exciting to Wincy Peng. She's the director of the Roll Right Skating Academy and the director and owner of Victoria's Roller Rhythm Skating Club. She talked to the CBC about the performance.
It popped up first on my Instagram feed, and I was like, no way, this didn't, did he actually? And then I saw a little bit more, and now I'm like scrolling through my Instagram, and every third post is Usher roller skating and people doing spin-offs of what he's done and other people already duplicating his performance. So it's been really exciting.
What have you been hearing from fellow skaters throughout the day?
Well, the first post I saw was somebody saying that they were brushing off their skates now that they've seen that Usher's brought roller skating back. They call Usher like an OG skater, right? So, I mean, it's interesting with him because a lot of people are kind of just picking this up right now because it's a fad.
Yeah.
But he's always been a roller skater since childhood, and he's been part of that community. And so to see that community brought to such a large stage like this, it's making everybody super excited to be able to showcase an underrepresented activity and community such as roller skating.
Break down his technique then for a quick moment. For anyone who hasn't seen it,
yeah.
I was so impressed because he was smooth as you like, and yet he was keeping the vocals smooth as well. What did you make of that?
I was so impressed with the whole crew, honestly. I see a lot of roller skating. My Instagram feed is just full of roller skating all the time, but I was so pumped with all of the cool moves that they busted out right from the... They had toe spins, yeah. And the skaters slid into the splits, and Usher did some really nice dips, and that's when you're like gliding backwards, and like you smooth roll into like a spiral... kind of glide.
Yeah.
I know. And then he slid through the other guy's legs.
He slid through Will.i.am's legs.
Yeah.
And Will.i.am's legs weren't even open that wide. I was like, I mean, to go for that at the Super Bowl live when millions of people are watching you, that takes charisma and courage. Nobody pulled it off.
Yeah. And to do that while singing with the lights and it was a lot. Yeah.
BC roller skater Wincy Peng speaking with Jason D'Souza, host of All Points West. Depending on your age, getting ID'd can be a rite of passage, a nuisance, or a compliment. But at 6 Liquor Control Board of Ontario stores, it will soon just be the norm. Starting this spring, the provincially run LCBO locations in Kenora, Sioux Lookout, and Thunder Bay will become the first in Ontario to take part in a controlled entrance pilot. In order to go inside, customers will need to scan a piece of government-issued identification at the door. Privacy experts have concerns, but the architects of a similar program in Manitoba say it has led to a massive reduction in theft, and our guest is hoping it will have the same effect in Ontario. Colleen McLeod is the chair of the Liquor Board Employees Division of the Ontario Public Service Employees Union. We reached her in Toronto.
Colleen, you've been hearing stories from your members, from people who work at these stores. What's an example of what they experience that would prompt a program like this?
Well, most recently, there's been, you know, escalating violence that has come along with the thefts in our stores. And, you know, our members obviously have some major concerns about their safety. And we have been advocating to our employer through our Provincial Health and Safety Committee to look at a model very similar to what's going on in Manitoba. It has worked. The people there feel a lot safer. So it's something that we have been advocating for.
What about you? You work in an LCBO store as well. Have you ever experienced this firsthand?
Yes. I mean, it's scary being a liquor store worker. You know, let's be clear. I mean, it's a great job, but, you know, it's not like selling jeans. It's not like selling milk, right? We deal with an addictive substance, and often that does come with, you know, sometimes threats of violence. Also, you know, our cars being vandalized. People being followed home, you know, these are things that, you know, come with the job.
To be clear for our listeners, this isn't just showing your ID as you might be asked to. Their ID will be scanned and held in a database for a couple of weeks, correct?
Yeah, that's my understanding. The information that we received is exactly the information that is available publicly on the LCBO's website, which is they keep the information for 14 days. And then after the 14 days, the information is no longer kept in any database. It's eliminated.
Even if it's for a short term, you can understand, I'm sure, that many people would be concerned about potential privacy issues. You know, people want to just make their purchases anonymously as they normally would. What do you say in response to those concerns?
Well, I would say that, you know, this small, you know, small infringement, you know, I would say is a small price to pay for the safety of members and to also secure the assets of the Ontario public. I mean, we as taxpayers own the LCBO. Those are assets that we own. And I think, you know, we've heard from a lot of customers as well that they're getting a little tired of this, and they would also like to see, you know, more done to secure those assets and prevent theft.
On the theft prevention piece in particular, could they not tag the bottles as, you know, in retail, other retail outlets, they have security tags on things? Is that a solution that was considered as well?
Well, I think, you know, the LCBO has done everything so far that they can, to be honest. I don't know how much further, really, other than, you know, looking at a model similar to Manitoba.
This will initially roll out in 6 stores. They're all in northern Ontario. What do you make of the locations that the government has chosen? Why did they pick those spots?
I can't speak to why. I mean, I think, would we as the union have loved to see more locations included in this pilot? Yes, we would have, for sure. But ultimately, the LCBO and the government or whoever made those decisions, made those decisions.
After the program in Manitoba that you've referenced rolled out its similar program, privacy experts expressed concern about what we discussed, that the customer data could be misused, but also raised concern that information could be used to unfairly target Indigenous people and other marginalized groups. Does that concern you at all?
Honestly, I can't speak to that.
Well, I was going to say, what could you as a staff member or a team at a store do to make sure that isn't happening?
Well, we already have extensive training regarding diversity, inclusion, you know, racial profiling. We get tons of training on that already, mm-hmm. right? So I'm not so concerned about my members, to be perfectly mm-hmm. honest with you.
And then there's the customer service piece of this. Are you concerned that this might just turn people off? That's just not a welcoming place, or it's too much of a hassle?
Yeah, and I think that, you know, there is a, you know, prevailing feeling that when you come into the LCBO, you know, it is a very welcoming environment. We take pride, obviously, in the work that we do, and we make sure that, you know, we provide that environment. It's the LCBO wouldn't discuss these type of measures with us. in the past. And we've been at, like I said, we've been advocating, but it wasn't a place that they wanted to go. And most recently, you know, after COVID, things have gotten a lot worse. Theft has increased. And as I said, the associated violence with that comes along with that theft has increased. So I think, you know, it's time that they look at doing more.
And I wanted to ask you what you think more beyond this might look like. Manitoba took other measures to reduce theft as well. They added more security staff members and loss prevention officers who are trained to actually be able to apprehend people who are taking things. So would you like to see all of that rolled out in Ontario as well?
Of course. And this is also something through our Provincial Health and Safety Committee that we've been advocating for is additional security, right? And security with the skills, like you said, as well, to, you know, deal with the situation. But we also don't want escalating violence in the store either. We do everything in our control to de-escalate in our locations. We all want to go home safe. We want our customers to go home safe. You know, I've worked for the organization for 26 years. The people that I serve are my community members. So I want everybody to go home safe. So I don't want any escalation of violence in our locations, to be perfectly honest. And if having, you know, ID checked at the door will eliminate some of that violence, I think it's a very, very small price to pay for people's safety.
Colleen, I appreciate your time. Thanks very much.
No, thank you very much. And you have a lovely day.
You too. Take care.
Thank you.
Colleen McLeod is the chair of the Liquor Board Employees Division of OPSU. We reached her in Toronto. This is a tune called Crooked Stovepipe, performed by legendary Métis fiddler Angus Beaulieu, who died on the weekend at the age of 89. Mr. Beaulieu was from Fort Resolution in the Northwest Territories. He first performed at a dance when he was just 14. He said his arms got tired that night, but he stuck with it anyway, and fiddle remained part of his life for more than 70 years. Among those remembering him this week is Linda Duford. She's with the Cole Crook Fiddle Association in Hay River, Northwest Territories.
I met him when I was about 18 or 19, living in Fort Simpson. He was the first Métis-style fiddler that I really ever heard in person. And we've been friends ever since, on and off over the years, always running into each other at concerts and festivals. And yeah, just an amazing person and really cherished the friendship.
Can you talk about his love for his craft?
We used to call him the walking museum. I mean, anybody who's ever been to Angus and Dorothy's in Fort Resolution will know the thrill of walking into their home and the whole place is full of fiddles and trophies and posters. And it's like walking into the past. There's really not a word to put to it. Angus was like the personification of music in the NWT. I mean, he lived it. He was it. Everything he did.
Linda, how would you describe his impact on fiddling in the North?
Oh, my goodness. You could go to any corner of the Northwest Territories or Nunavut or anywhere, and people knew who Angus was. He was just one of a kind. I mean, people respected him. They loved his music. He was a real celebrity in the NWT. And everybody loved him because he was such a nice person and willing to share his stories, share his music. You go visit him and he would walk you through anything you wanted to know, tell you the history of things. Just one of those people, one of a kind. He had a really storied and interesting life. So, I mean, I visit him, well, I can't even tell you how many times, but every time I've gone, I've gotten another story. And, you know, I Some of them I'd heard a couple of times, but it didn't matter because they were such good stories. I mean, my favorite one was Angus coming to a dance in Port Simpson, or not coming to a dance, coming to a dance in Hay River, coming over to Hay River, and their fiddler that they had for some reason couldn't make it. So they heard Angus was in town, but Angus didn't have a fiddle. So they found an old fiddle for him. It didn't have any strings. He rigged up some strings. He didn't have a bow. He cut a spruce branch off and strung some hair on it. He didn't have rosin, so he went and got some spruce gum. So, you know, this is just fascinating to me. And getting over here, the river was out and they had to portage over the river. Like, it's just amazing. And the best part of it is that all his stories were true. Unbelievable, but true.
Linda Duford is with the Coal Crook Fiddle Association in Hay River, Northwest Territories. She was talking to the CBC's Hilary Bird about her friend, the late fiddler Angus Beaulieu, who died on the weekend at the age of 89. For many of us, February 13th is traditionally the day we remember that we forgot that the next day is Valentine's Day, and then scramble to secure a dinner reservation or a gift that somehow suggests we didn't get it at a pharmacy. Well, for us, as it happens, it is also a day of self-love because it's a World Radio Day, which, according to UNESCO, honors, quote, one of the most dependable and widely utilized forms of media in the world, unquote. Oh, thank you. So we thought we'd mark the day by celebrating someone that Texans have been depending on for more than 70 years. Mary McCoy co-hosts a morning country show on K-Star Radio in Conroe, Texas. From our archives, here is Ms. McCoy speaking to Neil last March about being awarded the Guinness World Record for longest-serving female radio presenter in the world.
Well, Mary, congratulations, first of all.
Thank you so much. This is one real big honor, let me tell you.
Well, it's quite an honor speaking to you. So what's the secret to staying on the radio so long?
Well, because my love for people. I started when I was 12 years old. I knew what I wanted to do. You won't believe this. I knew what I wanted to do even back when I was 3 years old. I yodeled all the time. And I yodeled some on the radio, but I wanted my show more than that.
How did you know that's what you wanted to do?
Well, because I would listen to the radio on Saturday night out on the porch, front porch of my house. My daddy was working on a farm, and we'd sit there and listen to the Grand Ole Opry. Well, I wanted to sing and make records, but most of all, I wanted my own show on radio.
And you got it when you were 12. That's remarkable that you won a contest, right? And then
yes,
you said, I want my own show.
I was on a talent contest, and, well, the manager of the Crichton Theater in Conroe, and he told me that he wanted me to come up and that he heard a lot about me and wanted me to come up and be on the talent show. And after that, he said, do you know enough songs to do 15 minutes? Well, 15 minutes sound like an eternity to me, but I said, I think so. Well, he recorded me, told me to catch that big old Greyhound bus and go back home and listen to the radio at 1 o'clock. Well, I got as close as I could get to it, and I was so sorry, because I thought that was the worst thing I ever heard in my life when I heard myself sing. Of course, my mama, you know, told me right the opposite, and I didn't give up. That next week, well, I had a sponsor for my show. They called me from the radio station, and so I had that sponsor for a while where I sang, but I wanted to play records. I wanted to play the artist that I would hear sing, and I guess, you know, the good Lord has blessed me because I got to be on the stage with almost, not all of them, but most of them. I was there. I did two shows with Elvis. I was at really at four of them, but two of them where I was on the stage with him.
Yeah, let me ask you about that. So it's 1955.
Yes.
Elvis rolls into town.
That's
right, as his career is taking off or starting to take off. There's
That's
this great
right.
photo of the two of you together. Pretty cozy there, Mary, I got to say. Do you remember that moment?
Oh, yeah. I used to say, girls, eat your heart out. But no, he was, let me say that one thing about Elvis, I'm glad that I got to know him. He was just, you couldn't ask for a better person.
We're reaching you at K-Star Studios right now. How did today's show go, Mary?
Today, it was, well, it was very exciting because after I found out I was going to get to talk to you, Neil, I was more excited because I've always heard so much about Canada, and I've always wanted to visit Canada. I may never get to, but my voice will be there.
Oh, it absolutely will be, and it'll be in our archives forever, but you should come down and visit us sometime.
If it's all possible, maybe I will get to, Neil.
Well, maybe we'll get to meet face-to-face. When is it that you feel like, oh, that was a great show? What makes it a great show to you?
Well, it makes it a great show when you hear from your folk because I love people. Not only do I do my shows, but when I get off the air, I still go out and call on my people. I'm in sales, and this is what keeps me going, Neil, is the, and I can truthfully say it's the people. I love where I live. I couldn't ask for a better place.
Did you say you have another job? You're in sales on top of the show you host?
I have clients, and I'll tell you something else that I do for those clients, too. When I'm not too tired, I take them sourdough bread that I make over the weekend.
You're the kind of person that doesn't like to sit still. Is that right?
No, I have to be busy. I love what I do. And, of course, I know I probably run my co-host crazy sometimes when we're off the air, but I'm proud to say that I've had a lot of years working with, his name is Larry Gala, and he's been in radio a long time, too. And as a matter of fact, we did a commercial this morning. He said, well done. I said, well, you taught me well.
I have a pretty great co-host, too, Chris Howden, so I know how important that is. What is it like when you walk around? Are you a celebrity in your town?
I feel like I love everybody, Neil, and it's always a treat to go out and visit with my people. I call them my people because I have the largest family that you could ever have. Because when I call on a person, they become my family. It makes my day.
Oh, well, this has made my day, Mary. But before we say goodbye, before we let you go, you mentioned all the requests. You get in, you play requests for your listeners. But I want to give you a chance to play what you love, Mary. So is there a song we can play for our audience now? Maybe one of your all-time favorite country songs?
Well, could you play Elvis for me?
We absolutely can play Elvis. Which song?
Starting Today.
Thank you so much, Mary. It's a pleasure speaking with you.
Oh, it's a pleasure talking to you, Neil. And don't give up on me. Maybe I'll show up in your studio one day.
You are the last person I'm ever going to give up on, Mary. I'll tell you that much. Take care of yourself.
Thank you so much. It's been my pleasure.
From our archives, that was Mary McCoy, the co-host of the Larry and Mary Show on K-Star Radio in Conroe, Texas, speaking to Neil last March.
Starting today, I'm teaching my heart not to ache anymore. Just 'cause we're apart.
You've been listening to the As It Happens podcast. Our show can be heard Monday to Friday on CBC Radio 1, following the world at 6.
You can also listen to the show online at cbc.ca/AIH or on the CBC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks for listening. I'm Neil Kirksall.
And I'm Chris Howden.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.